with information on the latest developments in assistive technology and initiatives from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. RPH Australia brings you AbleQuest. Hello, I'm Marnie Roper. Today's program, the first of two on this subject, looks at one of the team members integral to the recovery of people who have suffered traumatic brain injury. Speech pathologists begin treatment in the very early stages, encouraging not just speech, but also swallowing and communication in general. Their involvement continues with the aim of gaining the most independence possible. To tell us more about this therapy, Barbara Sullivan spoke with Margie Logan, a speech pathologist practicing in Sydney. She asked her about traumatic brain injury and the role speech pathologists play in the recovery process.
Two, broadly speaking, types of traumatic brain injuries are either the closed head injuries, where you have a fall or a motor vehicle accident mainly, or the penetrating injuries, where it's localised, like a bullet in your head or a blunt force trauma,
right,
where you're hit in a spot on your head. It's usually the localised injuries that will cause the speech and language problem, and it's usually the other injuries, the closed head injuries, where there's acceleration, deceleration problems that will cause this other communication deficits that are high level, and speech problems are really common. Speech pathologists fundamentally work with either swallowing impairment or communication problems, simply put. Swallowing will vary from being able to swallow your secretions. So very early on in brain injury, people have tracheostomy tubes often. So it's whether or not the person can tolerate their secretions will dictate whether or not the tracheostomy tube can be removed. So that's the stage before they're trialing any oral food often. It also obviously is dealing with their capacity to safely swallow either food or drink. In terms of communication skills, they're pretty wildly varied in traumatic brain injury. To simplify it, the two broad areas are what we refer to as speech problems. And by speech, we're talking specifically about neuromuscular difficulties. So slurred speech or no speech.
Right.
Because of people's capacity to use the musculature required for actually physically speaking. So that's one area.
Mm-hmm.
The second area is language skills or cognitive skills. So language / cognitive skills. More often than not, in traumatic brain injury as opposed to other types of brain injury, it's what we refer to as a high-level communication impairment, and it's the cognitive skills that are impacting the people's ability to communicate successfully.
At what point do you become involved?
Really early on, actually, in the acute phase. The focus in the acute phase is usually swallowing. And it really depends, Barbara, a bit on the severity of the traumatic brain injury. So if we're talking about someone who's had a really serious injury and they're intubated, they've got a trache tube, they're tube fed because they're unable to eat, they're often not even conscious or barely conscious. In fact, always they go through a period of post-traumatic amnesia. Post-traumatic amnesia is the period after a brain injury which actually dictates the severity of the injury. It determines the classification. And it can range from an hour after the injury to many, many months to indefinitely. And it will also determine the severity of their cognitive deficits as well, usually. So certainly back in that acute phase with the swallowing, that will be the focus. We want to get people extubated, so we want to get the trachea tubes out. We want to get them back onto some sort of oral feeding. They have to be alert, obviously, to eat, but they don't have to be particularly responsive. So a lot of the focus very early on tends to be with swallowing. However, obviously, while you're going through that phase, always you're trying to make a determination about whether someone has some capacity to communicate. And again, if we're talking about someone with a severe impairment like that, so someone who's tube-fed, trachea tube, you know, opening their eyes, not even necessarily following gaze. So it almost looks like nobody's home. You know, the person's awake, but there's no processing going on. And that's a really severe presentation. So they haven't got the capacity to even want to communicate, let alone be able to if they could. However, during that early stage when you're feeding people, there will be times when you suddenly get eye gaze. So they either connect with your eyes, so you know that there's some connection, or they start squeezing your hand to responses, or they may even try to start mouthing things. So all the while, you're having to make determinations about people's capacity to start to engage. So you can even evaluate the level of communication ability or cognitive impairment.
Overall, what's the most important thing you're trying to achieve?
In the early stages, to set up some means with which they can communicate with you.
Right.
Fundamentally important, because otherwise people are hypothesizing about their level of ability to understand what's going on with them and their needs. And so if we can at all set up some means of communication, however primitive it might be, that would be a really important thing to achieve. Secondly, you know, on the other side, in terms of swallowing, the other thing that we would be trying to achieve then is to safely get this person to be able to eat and drink
mm-hmm.
on foods and fluids that are not going to choke them and are not going to be aspirated into their lungs. And they're two really big risks. At that early stage, there's not a lot that they would be capable of taking on to do mechanically. So even following an instruction, I want you to do this for me now in order to make this swallow better, is not something they're even capable of doing in the early stages often.
Well, let's suppose that they're at the stage where they are capable.
Yeah.
Are there specific techniques for stimulation and training the muscles to function normally again?
Absolutely, yes. One of the best things, interestingly enough, Barbara, you can do for swallowing is swallow. Makes sense.
Right.
It? As long as it's safe, as long as you're not increasing the risks, one of the best things, so we will try and get people onto some sort of food, even small amounts, in order to encourage them to swallow, managing their own secretions, which people, they're not swallowing them automatically, often forget to do. But even sitting down and encouraging people to swallow their own secretions is a really good training technique. There are also additional techniques that we're trained in swallowing, and there's numerous ones depending on the nature of the swallowing impairment that we can train people to use. For example, when the food goes down into your throat,
mm-hmm.
the bolus then has to pass into your esophagus to go to your stomach, as opposed to your trachea that will go into your lungs. There's a process that goes on when you swallow. Your larynx, which is your voice box at the top of your airway,
mm-hmm.
elevates. And you can feel it if you put your hand on the front of your neck and swallow. You can feel it raising up and down.
Yes.
Yeah?
I just did.
So when you... You're good. I'm glad it's working.
Mm.
So when it raises up and down, your vocal cords close as you do that. But also that elevation causes a little flap in your pharynx, that throat area, to fold down and shut over the top of your airway. That's called your epiglottis. So it all seals up beautifully nicely, and the food or fluid or saliva goes into your esophagus, and then you open up again to breathe. Now, sometimes with traumatic brain injury, that elevation doesn't occur properly. So one of the techniques that you can use to assist that process is simply tucking your chin in excessively. And by tucking your chin into your chest, so for someone who has that particular problem, that process can be helped by a reasonably simple thing, but they need to remember to do it all the time.
Now, let's suppose they're swallowing and chewing well. What about general speech skills and specific techniques for stimulation?
Okay. It's really important with speech. If we're referring to speech, so we're talking about neuromuscular function, so slurred speech, weak voice, insufficient breath support, inability to close off your nasal cavity, so you get a hypernasal quality to your voice, or reduced movement of your tongue or your lips. Any of those areas is going to cause some impairment of your ability to speak clearly. There can be very specific exercises in any of those areas, either respiratory, your voice box, palatal, or your articulators. The nature of the exercises is really, really important that you get the repetition, the frequency and the intensity all right. Certainly, giving people a set of exercises in terms of intensity and frequency, the more they do that, the better outcome they will have.
And families and carers are very involved.
The involvement of families, volunteers and care staff is really huge. It's really important.
Let's move on to rehabilitation of cognitive communication skills. Is improving the patient's attention an important area to start?
Oh, my word, it is, yes. There's various cognitive impairments.
Mm.
If we're talking attention specifically, there's three different types of attention. Selective attention, so being able to attend to something with background noise. There's sustained attention, which is being able to attend for a long period of time.
Mm.
And divergent attention, so being able to swap your attention from one thing to the other thing during a task. Any or all of those can be affected, and they have a big, big impact on people's ability to engage in treatment and to be able to set down memories for what they need to do.
Now, you said any or all of those can be affected. It's possible that you can be fine for sustained attention, but your ability for selective attention or divergent
yes.
attention goes.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, interesting.
Absolutely. So you, they're the type of clients that if you sit with them in a session, they're wonderful. They can stay there for the entire hour and pay absolute attention to what you're doing unless there's a noise somewhere or someone's doing something. And people will say, you know, I'm really good at doing my practice, except when if I'm in the living room and the television's on, I can't do it. So they have to lock themselves in a room, do it silently.
Give me a couple of examples of, you know, how you would do it.
Depending on what you're trying to achieve, often with that sort of person, let's say they're someone who has problems with selective attention that they can sustain. So they can independently go and work and concentrate for long periods of time, but they can't deal with distractors. And usually if they're talking one-on-one to someone, they're okay because they can focus on what they're supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to be doing it. But when they're in a group, because there's too many distractions going on, their capacity to concentrate on what they have to be doing is lessened. So they're often quite poor in group situations. It is really important that in addition to what you're trying to train, you're also aware that you're trying to teach the attention as well. So what you don't want to do is say, oh, well, your selective attention is terrible, so we'll do nothing about that. We'll just, you know, talk one-on-one and go to private rooms. What we want to do is try and sensitise them, so challenge them with increasingly, rather than putting them into a really crowded place and hope they survive it, just increase the complexity or the demands on their attention progressively. So they have to start dealing with what they're supposed to be doing with increasing levels of distractor.
Yes, because they might be able to go back officially to work, for example, because they can sustain their attention, but no workplace at all and no work situations are free of distractions.
Is that clinical? Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And the real world isn't. So often, and sometimes with people who do go back to the workplace, certainly we will be doing sometimes to get them started in the workplace, you might actually negotiate with the workplace that the person goes into a quieter situation if they can, rather than being on the front desk and dealing with too many things. So they might go and do data entry instead so they can concentrate for long periods of time. There's not too many, and then work their way up to that systematically.
And feel they're actually achieving something.
Yes.
I have been speaking with speech pathologist Margie Logan. We will continue our discussion in the next program of AbleQuest when Margie talks about technical aids available to help in the recovery of people who have sustained traumatic brain injury.
You have just been listening to AbleQuest, a program that looks at developments in assistive technology. From Barbara Sullivan and Marnie Roper, thank you for listening and goodbye till next program.